you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
What you're about to hear is the sixth and final part in the series May His Ka Endure Forever by Kevin Valbonesi. If you're jumping in right now, I highly recommend you go back and start your listening adventure with part one. Before we begin, a shout out to our latest patrons, Christopher James Frazier, Ian Carman, James Lindgren, George Bennetson, Andrew Tate, Kevin Comer, Debbie Schuler, and G. Mack. This show is dedicated to all of you. Thank you for believing in the Twilight Histories and helping to support us in our movement to grow this thing into something huge. I've got a couple guys waiting in the wings. They've got the writing jobs, they've got microphones, and they're itching to create new Twilight History stories for you. All we need is more patrons so we can hire them. If you haven't done so already, please head on over to our website at twilighthistories.com and sign up. You'll get access to over 50 shows, only available to patrons. And now, on to today's show, the finale of May His Ka Endure Forever, Part 6, by Kevin Valbonesi.
The assembled nations of Egypt's empire are all present here in the heart of Thebes, as the high priests compel them to gather around a sarcophagus which has not felt the cool night air for millennia. By force of sheer curiosity or by force of Egyptian spears and swords, the denizens of Thebes, foreigner and native alike, pour into the heart of the city, scrambling to get a look at the vessel in which a long-dead king supposedly rests. The air is charged, and your senses are overcome by a metallic taste and the sensation of a current running through your skin. Holding up your arm, you see the tiny hairs standing up, alert. You shove your way through the crowd, taking advantage of the general disorder to find a more suitable vantage point, one removed from direct sight of soldiers and priests alike. You steal yourself away into a grove, hiding within one of the huts used to prepare food and drink for those at leisure. The chaos of this impromptu gathering gives way to the measured order of ceremony. The priests, many donning the bestial masks of Egypt's pantheon, go out among the gathered crowds and chant about life beyond this mortal realm, and how they, the people, are to once again furnish the mansions of the gods. These esoteric words are spoken in an almost hypnotic fashion, their general strangeness amplified by the natural reverberance of the metal masks and the odd, uniform pace with which these holy men speak. The crowd, once rowdy and perhaps dubious, now stands silent. Such powers do these high priests of the lion cult wield that it is hardly a surprise that they could effect the construction of that unending necropolis beneath the sands of Egypt. You wonder if the power of suggestion wielded by these men is sufficient to make a man forget his time wandering and working among those subterranean stones. Finally, when it appears that all Thebes has been roused and brought to attention, the high priest addresses the gathered crowd, arms outstretched, his ghoulish aspect turned skyward.
"Long have we served the great house of that first king of the two lands. By his great deeds and the vigor of his house, we have gained dominion over all the lands beyond this fertile valley. No king stands before the might of our own. No army defies our will. No foreign god dares to intrude upon these blessed lands. All is as it should be. We are favored among the gods, and now they grant us one more gift."
The high priest turns to the sarcophagus and fiddles with the gemstones set into it. You feel the current in the air grow stronger, the taste of copper or iron in your mouth grow more intense.
Life is everlasting for those who follow the dictates of the gods. He who has so splendid a car that it is found without the weight of blemish may endure forever. So it is with our first king.
The sarcophagus begins to glow and rattle. The crowd gasps in unison, but none recoil. They all look on in pure astonishment as the inert metal finds vibrant life. The energy in the air is palpable, and as if drawing on it like a battery, the high priest becomes demonic in his aspect, relishing the coming act of divine trickery. You turn away, all too familiar with what comes next. Yet still, you feel the searing light as it radiates out, accompanied by the clanging of metal, as if some vast gate were slammed shut or thrown open by the hands of a titan. You hear the people cry out in terror and awe. You hear the high priests rejoicing, some unable to contain their laughter at so bold a trick played upon the ignorant populace. Then, the light dies away, and you turn once more to look upon the accursed sarcophagus. The crowd, too, looks upon the vessel with great interest, unsure of what's just taken place. But in a moment, any confusion is lifted. The sarcophagus opens, just slightly, letting out a whiff of air as if it were trapped there for millennia. Slowly, the thing opens, revealing its mortal contents. Some see him before others, and of those early to the sight, many crumble to the ground in pure ecstasy. Soon enough, the vision is one shared by the entire populace, and the effect is nearly universal. Those who do not collapse in sheer disbelief, or perhaps because of belief, kneel down and worship the specter standing before them. Your disgust at the sight is such that you spit upon the ground. You are, perhaps, the only one among the gathered denizens of Thebes to have anything but utter adoration for the triumphant pharaoh. The man, carrying himself with all the pomp and arrogance expected of a cult's high priest, strides forward in immaculate robes, his head adorned with the dual crown of Egypt. He holds the crook and flail in hand, and he raises both high above his head as he greets the crowd. Eternity greets you, my children. Too many years have I been away from this blessed valley. Though I enjoyed the company of Amun, I have longed to see you all dearly. And so, I have secured passage back to the realm of the living. And oh, what great abundance I see gathered before me. You have been fruitful and vigorous. My descendants and your ancestors have made this a truly great land. You are all worthy, and so I bring to you great tidings. For those who show themselves most pious, I may bestow upon them the gift of life everlasting. Your flesh shall not turn to dust, but it shall endure as mine has. We shall live as the gods do, and in time we shall dwell among them when the land has been made ready. Such hollow words ring true in the ears of the ignorant, and the crowd's delight at hearing such sweet lies summons forth adulation unlike any you have ever heard before. Men and women do everything but outright offer to enslave themselves to the lying pharaoh, pleading for their chance at life eternal. If only they knew, but then what difference would it make? Who among the people would believe your heresy after they had just witnessed a miracle? It would take the untimely death of he who had just asserted the material truth of eternal life to wrangle the senses of the Egyptians and free them from his spell. And just then, a kernel of an idea springs forth in your mind. Despite your desperation to return to your own time, your sheer revulsion at the arrogance of this man drives you to forsake your own desires in favor of pure, unadulterated retribution. All your life, you have been a thief, a deceiver, a thug even. But you could never dream of perpetuating such cruelty upon an entire nation of people. This affront cannot stand. And so you begin plotting the untimely demise of the living God King. You slither off into the darkness of a nearby alley, passing by enraptured Egyptians unnoticed. You cradle the cold metal of a falcon head mask, the visage of Horus, the corners of its beak curling up into an almost human sneer. The thing is heavy, the interior wet with the sweat of the poor fellow who was wearing it just moments ago. The thing made for a fine blunt weapon when you pulled it from the head of a priest who was hurrying down one of the few empty streets in Thebes. The man went down in a single blow, and you made quick work of pulling his limp body from sight, dumping him into the pond at the nearest grove. The man's robes are not an ideal fit, but you are not spoiled for choices, and the sheer number of men in priestly robes may spare you from the gaze of more hostile eyes. Stalking about, being mindful of the numerous soldiers and high officials marching throughout the city, you try to acquire any lead, any insight into what the Pharaoh and his men are doing in the wake of his miraculous return to life. Speculation is rampant, and you hear everything from mundane chatter about him establishing a new harem to fantastic ramblings about the Pharaoh literally summoning the other gods of Egypt to the mortal realm. All things are possible in the eyes of the credulous masses. Not a soul is without excitement, and how could they not be? To them, immortality is the great prize promised by a millennia of dogma, and now the living have seen concrete proof of it. The legends were true. The king had not died, but had strolled into paradise, and now he had returned to share the bounty with his loyal subjects. You come upon a group of officials overseeing the collection of several baskets, all filled to the brim with wheat, lentils, figs, and all the splendor of the Nile's bounty. The farmers hauling these goods in look ragged, drenched with sweat, and not a little taken aback by the stern castigation of the officials. These scribes curse the farmers for not collecting the produce soon enough, which they consider an insult to the needs of the living God King. Looking around you, you see that in the span of just a few hours, the farmers closest to the city, and especially those within its vast walls, have all reaped their crops in haste for the pleasure of the Pharaoh. Clearly, some great feast is in the works. A familiar smell wafts through the air, and even under the heavy mask, it strikes you long before its source does. A couple of Nubians hauling large baskets of freshly roasted coffee beans bump into you as they hurry down the street, spilling some of their cargo. They are about to make trouble for you, but upon seeing your mask and robes, they cast their eyes down, apologize, and hurry on their way. Noticing the commotion, one of the royal officials strides over, stopping right in front of you.
"You're not supposed to be here."
You say nothing, simply standing there, trying your best to look severe and self-serious. Your silence works, with the official taking a step back.
"Apologies. I was saying that you're supposed to be across the river by now. His Majesty's great ritual is already underway."
Again, you say nothing, simply bowing due to the restricting fit of your mask. The official gets back to his business, delivering a kick to a man hauling a basket full of pomegranates. Across the river, perhaps at that city of the dead, which is only an overwrought gate for that unending labyrinth beneath the shifting sands. Does he mean to raise the treasures hoarded there for millennia to live in decadence, unable to spend the vastness of his riches? Of course he does. Now you move with purpose across the city, laboring under that heavy mask. Only the occasional breeze prevents you from slipping into complete delirium as you hurry towards the next covered grove where you can slip off the mask and splash water down your throat. If anyone were to pay you any mind, or disregard their obvious veneration of the priestly class, they may be horrified at the way you're walking now, taking wide steps, swaying from side to side. Will alone keeps you going, and will alone is what finally carries you to the bridge crossing the River Nile. Your last drink of water is already 20 minutes behind you, and the distance between here and the necropolis is not insignificant. Fixing your eyes on the great stone edifices in the valley, you can just about make out a faint glow in the wisps of dust drifting skyward from the impetus of hundreds of feet. That way lies the wretched pharaoh and his accursed vault of the damned. Not wanting to linger, for soldiers too are walking that way, you continue onward, advancing into the heart of the necropolis. Coming down the great ramp, you find that the city of the dead is very much alive. Where once the structures had been empty, standing as wasteful tributes to the memory of the supposedly dead king, now every structure is occupied, glowing from within by the light of great flickering flames. Peering into every window, you find a multitude of mass priests carrying libations, sacred fetishes, and exotic luxuries. The flames illuminating the buildings cast sinister reflections off the masks of the priests and silhouette others so that they indeed look like bestial half-breeds. As you advance further down the ramp, you find more soldiers and workers. As you suspected, every effort is being made to carry out the spoils of countless wars entombed within those long corridors and vast chambers. Gold, ivory, obsidian, rubies, and sapphires, and jars of precious oils pass from the tired hands of the workers and into the greedy claws of the masked priests who adorn the chambers of Pharaoh's new capital. You even spy masons and high officials inspecting the empty canals, presumably discussing how they can quickly deliver more water on such short notice. Finally, reaching the end of the ramp before the yawning gateway into the subterranean city, you find an assembled mass of priests, all adorned with their animal aspects. Anubis the jackal, Sobek the crocodile, Bast the feline, and Tawaret the hippo, among others. They crowd around a hastily prepared plinth upon which the lying pharaoh sits enthroned, flanked on either side by priests wearing set masks. The high priest stands before the pharaoh, holding court.
The preparations are almost complete. Soon, the mansions of the gods shall be furnished, and we, the faithful acolytes of the Undying, shall live in splendor. Under His Majesty's guidance, we shall stride forth once more into the world and place the furthest reaches of the four corners under our dominion. Great Kemet, by the glory of her first and mightiest king, shall be a shining empire without end.
A resounding applause goes out among the gathered priests, and you are a little late to join in, drawing the ire of those around you. Acting quickly, you too applaud the fiends before you, preserving your cover.
Come now, and join us for a great feast. We shall dine on the accumulated bounty of the two lands, and satisfied, we shall herald the beginning of a glorious new era before the gathered multitudes.
Another round of applause goes out, and this time you're on cue. The pharaoh rises from his throne and joins the high priest on a leisurely walk towards the large structure within the necropolis. You too follow, joining the large procession of priests. You all move at a steady pace past the swarming crowds of officials, soldiers, and laborers. You marvel at how easily one man bends an entire nation to his will. He's been here in Thebes for a few hours at most, and already the entire population is working like a well-oiled machine on overdrive, entirely dedicated to pleasing the whims of this one man. As you approach the soon-to-be royal residence of the deceitful king, you can't help but be impressed. Statues carved in the sinister likeness of the king serve as columns, raising up the grand roof. The walls are covered in beautiful frescoes, done not in the Egyptian manner, but that of the Minoans, showing Pharaoh and his court reveling in their supreme luxury. A balcony overlooks the approach, round and open onto the cool night air, giving the perfect stage from which the king may deliver his wicked soliloquies. The doors, too, are works of art, depicting the fierce aspect of the god Set, wielding the crooked flail as if he were ruler of the two lands. Waiting soldiers pull on massive chains, drawing the great doors open, revealing the sumptuous dwellings within. As you cross the threshold and enter into that den of pharaonic decadence, you wonder if it, unlike the labyrinth before, may become your tomb. For a culture so entranced by the mysteries of the afterlife, the Egyptians of this world, or at least their priestly class, are quite the bon vivants. This palatial structure you now find yourself in is the den of the truly decadent. You marvel at how every luxury has been arranged for the pharaoh and his faithful in so short a span of time. Were you not consumed with murderous intent, you could easily find yourself lost in the panoply of aphrodisiac pursuits. All around you, priests recline or sit on woven basket chairs, tended to by women in the most sultry of cosmetics. Wine, beer, and coffee flow freely into the gyrating cups of the already drunk. Attendants fan great palm leaves or hurry about carrying figs, dates, oranges, and other fruits in great baskets to the grubby mitts of the priests. There's a small pool in the center of the room, fed by narrow canals which run from under the walls and across the floor on either side. Musicians stand around the pool, strumming the chords of lyres to produce the most delicate and sumptuous sounds you've heard since you first arrived in this land. The chamber's acoustic quality is excellent, and no matter where you go in the room, you find that the music is always clear, audible, and soothing. There's a second floor, a gallery which opens up onto the main floor. Up there, Pharaoh and his inner circle engage in secret colloquy. Most have their masks off, but not all, mercifully. You drift about the room, working your way towards the staircase at the far wall which grants access to the second floor. Even now, as you make your approach, your mind is racing, searching desperately for anything resembling a kernel of a plan. All you know is that you must kill the pharaoh. How to do so or how to escape from the immediate consequences still eludes you. There are no readily available weapons, save for what the few guards permitted inside carry. You won't get those easily enough, and you won't reach Pharaoh if you must waste precious moments prying one from the hands of its owner. You could use your bare hands, but Pharaoh showed himself a capable fighter back in the underground world, and you are without Memnon's aid now. The moment you lay your hands on him, 10 more will be tearing at you, pulling you away, or worse, he will throw you from the second floor and down onto the cold stone below. How then do you do it? And how soon can it be done? Your body is racked by the effects of hunger and thirst once more, and you fear that when the decisive moment comes, you will lack the strength to see it through. group of masked priests approach the stairs, and seeing your opportunity, you stride over, careful not to break into a jog lest the guards find anything amiss with your urgency. You tag along, catching the tail end of a conversation about the other pharaoh, the one up in the delta. These masked priests speak in hushed tones, wondering what will become of the young king in the north. A general consensus forms that the young king would do best to abdicate, for good as he has been, he can hardly hold a candle to the immortal founder of the realm. As you reach the second floor and gather around an open window, the conversation takes a comic turn, with the priests wondering what on earth they're going to do with their unlimited years. It would appear that not everyone here is privy to the truth of the matter, and they are going along with it as the masses do, in ignorance. You take leave of the group before they can rope you in, and take up your position at another window, within earshot of the pharaoh and his inner circle, but obscured by another group of priests in the midst of great revelry. Your mask makes it hard to hear everything, but you're close enough that you can catch most of what the pharaoh is saying to the high priest and the others in their inner cult. Has word gone north yet? The high priest clears his throat and waves his claw of a hand.
None of ours have said a thing, but word will travel down the Nile soon enough. What would you have us do? He is the king, too.
I have made arrangements on the other side. He will be informed, and should he go peacefully, he will be looked after.
And what shall we tell the people?
What else? That he has crossed over as I did. To walk among those who live forever. The two share a private chuckle. You will take his place in the Delta, to oversee things. But don't misunderstand me. You are still just a priest. The two crowns rest on my head. Your predecessors did well to remember that.
Of course, Your Majesty.
The priest gives the faintest bow and then takes up a nearby cup of wine, passing the dark liquid past his leathery lips. The pharaoh remains silent, his eyes cast down, his brow furrowed.
Your Majesty?
The two from the underground, the thieves. Do we know what became of them? Your ears perk up at this, and you inch a little closer to hear, still mindful of the need to maintain your cover.
They escaped by way of one of your temples, but our men found no one on the road to the city. I suspect that they wandered into the desert to avoid being caught, and they perished from the heat.
But how do you know for certain?
No one has seen them, Your Majesty. We have nothing to fear from them speaking out. And who would believe such men?
But you don't know. This outburst silences the revelry immediately. Everyone freezes. The music stops. The pharaoh seethes. But feeling all eyes on him, he composes himself quickly and turns to the gathered crowd. He is about to speak when a soldier runs into the palace and, glancing around, spies the pharaoh up top. The soldier bows and looks up, awaiting permission to speak. The pharaoh assents.
The people of the city are on their way, Your Majesty.
Oh, wonderful. Bid them come, but do not let them come too close to the palace.
Yes, Your Majesty.
The soldier runs out, calling to his comrades. Pharaoh turns his attention back to the gathered crowd of priests and addresses them. Come, my friends. Join me in greeting the multitude. They long for everlasting life, and we shall not deny them their hope. With that, Pharaoh turns and heads for the balcony. You want to follow him right away, but again, the moment has not come. Instead, you hang back, waiting for a sufficient number of priests to pass you by before moving along with the crowd, mindful to always stay near the front, always waiting for the moment to strike. What makes a man into a god? How does mere flesh transcend its profane nature? Is it by the ascent of some unseen master or elder god? Or is it simply a matter of belief? In this moment now, with the blood moon hanging in the sky and the assembled masses of Thebes standing in awe-struck silence, the earthly pharaoh standing at the edge of the palace balcony may as well be Amun himself. You stand at the back of the balcony in the company of several other priests, watching as the pharaoh leans forward, silent, his kingly regalia giving off a sinister glow in the sanguine light of Khonsu. The man is relishing the moment as you stand there, so close to exacting some measure of vengeance, but so uncertain about the right moment and manner to strike. Do you know what I love about eternity? The pharaoh addresses the crowd as if speaking with an intimate acquaintance. The passing of days becomes meaningless. In this mortal life, we are allotted a pittance of time with which we are to make our mark upon this world. We toil every day, and we die before our work is truly done. But in a land without death, you can give yourself over to every pursuit. Imagine a world where you always have time for all the most precious things. That is what I offer you now. We can all live on without fear. The heavy burden of your hearts need not be weighed by the gods. We can be free for eternity. The crowd hangs on his every word. Some are reduced to tears. They all look on without a doubt in the world, entranced by the promise of an earthly immortality, free from that definitive and deadly first step required by the true Egyptian conception of the afterlife. If he took a different tact and commanded them all to kill themselves on the spot, you have no doubt that they would enact the deed without hesitation. If you wish to live as I do, continuing on without end, free from the oppression of our earthly mortality, then you must give yourselves over to the great order that is Maat. The gods have shared their laws with me, and I have committed them to memory. If you do as I dictate, then you can live as I do. The pharaoh looks well contented with himself. His audience is as captive as they come. Now, show me that you are willing to do all that is necessary. Kneel. The command echoes out across the valley, and it is heeded almost immediately. All take a knee, including those among your number. You're late to it, but a neighboring priest pulls you down. The pharaoh leans back, crosses his arms. You hear him chuckle. All hail the king. The pharaoh laughs to himself as his unwitting subjects prostrate themselves before him. Something snaps in you then. The hubris of that man becomes too much for you to bear any longer. You had come here to plunder, but to perpetuate such brazen deceit onto a populace, perhaps for their entire lives. No, that is too far. No one would miss a bit of ivory or gold, but this man is plundering a generation at least. You don't even realize that you're standing until the priest who previously yanked you down is pawing at your leg. You brush him off and begin to walk forward, quietly, casually. Then, about halfway to the pharaoh, you pick up speed, and before you know it, you're surging forward. Pharaoh doesn't realize anything is amiss until you're about to reach him. He turns and thrusts his arms out, seizing you. But your momentum is too great, and you barrel into him, sending you both flying out over the ledge and onto the cold, hard ground below. The landing is anything but soft.
But fortunately, you kept Pharaoh below as you plunged down, leaving him to take the brunt of the fall. Still, the shock is immense, and you're certain that you felt more than one of your bones crack. Your mask also flew off, clattering to the floor next to you. As you pull yourself off the Pharaoh's body, you realize that you're not going to be running out of here. A stunned crowd watches you, and the motionless body next to you. And above, the priests gather at the edge of the balcony to gaze down at you. Even the soldiers, mere feet from you, stand by, unsure of how to proceed. You hear a guttural gurgling, and you glance back to see that the Pharaoh is alive, if just barely. He spits up blood and props himself up on one arm with great difficulty. Looking down at his mangled legs, he lets out a deep sigh and looks over at you, murder in his eyes. "Now why go and do a thing like that? You were off scot-free. I just wanted some trinkets. But you wouldn't even let me have that. You think I'd let you keep all of this?" Professional jealousy. That I can understand. At least you're getting all high and mighty with me. Well, I am just a lowly thief. Well, you'll be leaving empty-handed tonight. And with that, the Pharaoh gurgles and spits up blood once more before finally going limp. You roll over on your back, trying to catch your breath. But your respite is short. Several hands seize you, and before you know it, punches and kicks are raining down on you. The soldiers who had previously stood by are now doing everything in their power to make your passing a painful one. Goaded on by the high priest who shouts, "Kill him! Kill him!" from up on the balcony. You know that you're not making it out alive, so you don't fight back. And really, what could you do? But in your final lucid moments, you muster your remaining strength and call out to the shocked Egyptians. "They lied. They're lying to you. He's a man. A man. They lied. It's all a lie." You shout and shout, hoping that someone among the thousands there will realize what you mean. And someone does. The blows cease, and the soldiers rush off, rolling over and coughing up blood. You see the soldiers rushing into the palace, forming up at the door with swords drawn. Rolling over again with great pain, you see several citizens advancing, fists clenched, a crazed look in their eyes. You consider pleading for help, but you know it would be futile. You will not be returning to your own time. As the aggravated citizens of Thebes charge forward, they pay you no mind, some trampling right over you as they surge forward to confront the soldiers, likely on their way to pulling the priests apart limb by limb. And as more and more feet cascade over you, the sensation of pain evaporates, oddly enough. As you lay on your back, you catch fleeting glimpses of the sky between the rushing bodies of the Egyptians. You see the stars stretching out to infinity. Even though you are about to be lost in time, incalculable eons away from the reality you called home, you can at least take solace in the fact that the twinkling lights above are not so different from your own. And perhaps, when you finally pass on, your spirit may venture into the dazzling expanse and eventually find its way home.
As you may know, our Patreon area has grown to the point where we have brought Kevin on to produce monthly shows for patrons. So not only are we going to have Kevin creating shows in the podcast feed, but we'll also get a monthly show from him in Patreon. That's in addition to my own shows, which I'm doing exclusively for patrons right now. Last month, Kevin did a chilling show that takes place in the final years of the Roman Empire, a story about a Roman officer being escorted into a wilderness for execution as a blood debt. This month, Kevin takes us on to the jungles of the New World. A group of conquistadors discover an ancient civilization and the demon they worship. We're experimenting with a bit more of a fantasy element here at the Twilight Histories. If the multiverse is truly infinite, then so too are the possibilities. So in the spirit of ever-expanding creativity, we're breaking the laws of physics. You can listen to that show and join us in our experiments by visiting twilighthistories.com. That's twilighthistories.com. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.